I am Robert Taylor, and this is my cue list.
Cue List, brought to you by Same Same But Black, a collection of queer conversations released during Auckland Pride. I'm your host, Michelle, from Same Same But Black. So, welcome to QList 2024. My name's Michelle Maskell, and this is for Same Same But Black. And we have the beautiful opportunity to speak to the wonderful Robert Taylor, who's zooming in all the way from the UK. And so time zones applicable, it's his morning and my evening. But I hope you're relaxed when you start to listen to Robert Taylor's QList, because it's quite a cue in the list. So let's hand over to Robert. Give us an introduction. Tell us about yourself.
Hi, Michelle. I'm just so delighted to be here. And I am a Black queer photographer. For the last nearly 40 years, it's been the center of my creative life, my emotional life. And it's basically about exploring and celebrating who people can be. And I've had some wonderful opportunities to do that in academe, in the arts, in queer zones, and it just keeps on delivering. As I come up to my 66th birthday, not too far ahead, I've just completed the biggest project ever, and it was completely and totally queer, Black centered, and it was a big success. I'll no doubt tell you more about it as this goes on.
Thank you. I'm excited. So let's talk about your cue list and why. So, first question, often the most dynamic. How difficult was it for you to make these choices and why?
There were two stages to this challenge. At first, I was near to having a meltdown when I was trying to see how I could cram my whole life into three examples in each category. Then I calmed down and I was able to focus much more easily on things that ticked two boxes. They have some resonance today, and they may or may not go back a long, long way, but it's about the quality and resonance now. And it does still mean that some of my choices go back a very long way, back into the 70s in some cases, but it's mostly about what's making life work now. And I should add, it was something to celebrate. Trying to answer your questions gave me a little almost celebratory tingle, thinking, gosh, that was my life. Woo.
Let's head to your song selection. So we chose three songs. So let's start with Looking Around by Stevie Wonder. And this was 1971.
Stevie Wonder is, for me, a Black superhero. I had to have Stevie as one of my tunes because that man's output, both as a musician and as a human being, gave me somewhere to look where I could feel proud, engaged, and challenged. And I remember I was 13 when I heard this song. And he wasn't yet a megastar, but it was already clear he was going to make big waves in a music world that went way beyond the usual categories for Black artists. And Stevie Wonder manages to give me everything I need as a Black man, a Black person, a Black queer person. But he also has a message that is somehow powerfully universal without being bland.
We love a bit of Stevie. Somehow in every family gathering, the Stevie Wonder track comes out for all of us. Moving on to the second track in this selection, We Can Work It Out. I can almost hear the melody. Speak to us why, how, and when this came into your life.
Well, Chaka Khan came into my life in the 1970s when I was serving in the British Royal Air Force. And I remember hearing some of her early work with the band Rufus. And as a lot of her songs are soundtracks to big chunks of my life, disastrous love affairs, partying, you name it. But this track is Chaka at her smart, carnal best. But it's also an hilarious cover of a Beatles classic. It's got pomp, swagger. She gives us her trademark wail throughout and particularly at the end. And I've been listening to this track for decades and it still gives me a tingle. this woman is everything that I need from a female vocalist. Oh.
I want to say Chaka Khan.
Yes.
Oh, too good. And then we have the Blackbirds in a duet with David.
Right. Well, Permissible Beauty is a massive two-part project I've been working on with David McCalmont, the beautiful, hyper-talented musician and now art historian. We've been working on this since 2019. It was a big project with a lot of other collaborators, but David invited me to get involved, and we were at the core, the creative soul, if you like, of this project. And it's called Permissible Beauty because it's a look from a very contemporary and Black queer perspective on what we mean by human beauty, and also looking at some of the problematic ways in which some decades, centuries old ideas of beauty that tend to focus on thin white folks have somehow managed to permeate the world and make us all feel inadequate if we're paying attention to them. So David came up with the idea of the audacious idea of going to Hampton Court Palace, where they have a collection of paintings called The Winds of Beauty. It's a set of women from the 17th century who were basically King Charles II's eye candy. And we gently and respectfully unpackage the ideas that made them seem beautiful. And then we brought in six Black queer performers to talk about what they saw there and to create a whole new set of portraits that celebrate Black queer beauty, but in a universal sense that says, whoever you are, whatever shape or size or age or inclination, there is a conversation about beauty that could and should include you. And there are two parts, as I say. There was a massive two-month installation in the palace at Hampton Court Palace. And we also made a film. And in the film, after lots of beautiful oratory and discussion and sweeping through the halls, we end up in this scene between David McCalmont and the Gâteau Chocolat, where they're singing to each other. It's not literally talking about beauty, but it's a passage in the film that still brings me to a point of almost tears when I hear it. It's just one of those little exquisite artistic miracles. And I just hope people get to see our film. I'm going to do a shameless boast here in case anybody's in London between now and April the 28th, because you can go and see our film. It is part of the Welcome Collections exhibition called The Cult of Beauty. And they loved our film so much, they built a cinema inside their exhibition to show our film twice an hour every day until April.
Don't miss it, folks. If you're in London and the UK before the end of April in 2024, make sure you get down and watch Permissible Beauty. Moving on. And it seems like we should spend so much longer on those two, three songs. But moving on to the books, starting with James Baldwin.
Yes.
Talk to me about his, and I don't want to appear biased, so talk to me about James Baldwin, his impact on you and his biography.
Well, it's funny, I'm just feeling a bit emotional as I start to think what I'm going to say first, because it made such an impact on me. I knew James Baldwin was around. He was a name, you couldn't avoid him. But it was in the early 90s when I was definitely becoming established in my identity as a photographer and really wanting to explore the world of art as an expression. And I know there's this cliched saying, you can't be it if you can't see it. I'm not sure I'd go quite that far, but it's definitely the case that if you're a Black queer person moving in any of the major fields of endeavor, it really helps if there's somebody not just like you, but who's also the embodiment of excellence with heart. And when I read this biography of James Baldwin and I got to learn about his life and how he dealt with his challenges and his exquisite and limitless capacity to frame the world in ways that open our eyes, challenge us, inspire us, and give us permission to be outrageous in what we need to get on with, I felt liberated by him. It was after reading this biography that I was able to attempt my first serious artwork, where I felt, yes, I can take up a whole gallery with an installation. I can say things that might make some white folks a little bit uncomfortable. But it was also an exhibition which I was proud to take my mother to, who is not an habitué of the art scene, but she got it. And I think it was partly because I felt confident and proud of what I'd done. And that was partly out of the inspiration of James Baldwin.
Thank you, James. We live in your legacy. And to the second book, The Chiffon Trenches. I've not read this, but please tell me why and when and how this book made this to the list.
Well, The Chiffon Trenches by the fabulous, inimitable André Léon Talley, who is this gorgeous mountain of a man, well, was sadly, he died recently. He was an associate editor of American Vogue, but he was so much more than that. Coming from relatively humble beginnings in a part of America that was really not cool if you were black, he managed to refine his sense of what the world was about, get himself educated, break out of that humble beginning and project himself into a world that was, I don't think it was ready for what was coming. He managed to attach himself to some of the biggest names in fashion and became an authority, an icon, and also an outrageously entertaining commentator on the world of fashion. So this title, The Chiffon Trenches, takes us through his adventures, lots of triumphs, but also some really gut-wrenching difficulties that he had to go through, dealing with the racism and homophobia that he'd find at times. But overall, an inspirational figure. I've read it twice, and I'll probably read it again before next year is over, because it's just lovely to hear what's possible. And as a result, again, a bit like James Baldwin, experiencing Black queer excellence in a creative field just reminds me I'm allowed to take up space. I'm allowed to have my own dreams. And I'm allowed to say what I feel needs to be said without fear or favour.
Amen to that. Well, Francis Bacon, what can we say? The gilded, gutted life of Francis Bacon.
Well, Francis Bacon is one of those artists for whom I have huge admiration in some of the ways he lived his life. And particularly the quality and the bravery of the work he created. But Francis Bacon was one of those first examples where I felt I didn't need to meet my hero. But The Gilded Gutter Life of Francis Bacon is written by somebody called Daniel Farson, who was a sort of a kind of friend of his who had a ringside seat at some of the biggest adventures in this outrageous, and I mean really outrageous, personal life. It was obviously the context in which he was able to produce this startling and challenging work. I remember the first time I saw a Francis Bacon exhibition. It was a retrospective at Tate Britain. I was so affected by it, I had to rush out to an art shop and get some materials. I just had to make marks on paper. It's not my art form, as it turns out, but it's the only way I could deal with the feelings. And although he's a posh Anglo-Irish white man from another era, I felt very connected with him as a creative soul. And this biography gets down to some really messy stuff, but it still left me inspired and wondering, you know, how he survived and how he managed to turn out so much amazing work when his life was such an incendiary and often catastrophically messy setup.
Sidebar, the man, I love him, but he was a car crash.
Yes. Pile up.
Yeah. Oh,
and there is one other thing. I'm being naughty because it's not on my list of favorite films, but there is a film based on the book called Love is the Devil. And even though the filmmakers were not allowed to use the Francis Bacon estate wouldn't let them use any of his paintings, the director did a brilliant job of styling and color mooding the film. So many parts of the film, you felt you were in a Francis Bacon painting. So I'd recommend that as the accompaniment to reading that book, but we haven't got to my films yet.
Moving on to your film selection. So we've got three films here. I'll just name them quickly and we'll go back and cover them. So we've got Some Like It Hot, Brothers Outsider, and Permissible Beauty, starting with Some Like It Hot, which is a classic for many people in an era where We Were Seen Unseen. Speak to us why you chose this film and when did you first see it and why does it still carry importance?
I'm guessing I first saw it in the 70s. And although I was completely clear in my queer identity for myself, back in those days, it was not a conversation at home. And I was not out there waving flags or marching or even being in relationships. It was just a sensibility that was deep within me, accepted within me, though I had no idea how to deal with it. So that first viewing was shocking. It was sort of outrageousness in plain sight and how Mr. Curtis and Mr. Lemon got away with that, I don't know. It was so queer. And I've watched it several times over the years and realized more and more how outrageous it was and how clever it was to be so flagrant in our face and yet somehow not outraging people. So brave and so well done and, you know, packed with talent, all of whom seem to be firing at quite a high level. I love it. I'm probably going to watch it again at some time over Christmas when I've had a, you know, maybe one or two too many and just see if there's yet more to discover as my own life has opened up more. Love that film so much. And that last scene, I mean, wow, how did they get away with that? The last scene I'm referring to is when Lemon, his sort of weird connection with a man who didn't seem to realize it was a man in drag. And when the truth came out, the man was still happy to stay there. I mean, that is a 21st century message. And yet they got away with it in the 50s. Wow.
Love is love. That's what they say. Love is love.
Yes. Yes.
Love is love. And moving on to quite a moving documentary, Brother Outsider. For many people who are now encountered Bernard Rustin of him in his time and now finally celebrating him in his truth. Talk to us about Brother Outsider and the impact it had when you saw it.
Well, I first saw Brother Outsider because I happened by just lucky chance. I, with my partner Tristram, met the directors and some of the people who produced the award-winning feature-length documentary that is called Brother Outsider. And I thought my cup was running over already with people like James Baldwin, but to see somebody who was at the core of such an important movement in American and world history, this documentary brought out not just the scale of this man's talents and achievements, but also the humanity of the man, the warmth, the humor, the frailty, the vulnerability, and a soaring capacity to inspire people around him. Just he's somebody who I wished I did have the chance to meet, because there's something I would somehow bizarrely wish I could catch from him. The man had charisma to burn, a generosity of spirit and courage, which took him to places that, you know, most human beings don't get to. A lovely character. And yes, there now is a biopic which sort of gives a fictional, well, not fictionalized, I mean, what it depicts is true on Netflix. And I actually like the fact that there are these two films sitting side by side, but my favorite is definitely the documentary because it focuses on the fact. It doesn't speculate. And we see a lot of footage of the man himself, and it's very easy to see why he caused such a stir wherever he went, not just in American politics, but around the world. Beautiful soul. And another example of Black queer excellence.
All day, all day. And then we move to moving on to Permissible Beauty, again a short film released in 2023 in the UK. Hopefully one day we'll get a screening in New Zealand, just saying.
Well, Michelle, I am going to shamelessly now celebrate and promote a film that I actually had a big hand in creating. As I explained at the top of the program, my dear friend of three and more decades, David McAlmont, approached me in 2019. At that point, you know, we'd already had 30 odd years of being a mutual admiration society. And I was in awe of the music and more recently, the art history career he's carving out for himself. So when he said to me, Robert, I've got an idea for a project and I want to work with you on this. I need you in this. I was a bit apprehensive at first, not because I doubted David's ability to do anything, but I wasn't so clear about what I could bring to such an audacious, such an outrageous concept and the ideas he had for it. But we got to work and we were able to attract some brilliant talent in the form of Professor Richard Sandel, who was the overall producer, you might say, of the whole enterprise, and Mark Thomas, who was the film's director, and lots of other people in terms of design and strategy, not to mention the amazing people at Hampton Court Palace, who made us so welcome and saw us as an opportunity. And this went way beyond, you know, equality and diversity box ticking. They saw us as an opportunity to bring their collection to life and open up a much bigger conversation. And we got away with it. Well, more than got away with it, it's the gift that keeps on giving, as we now see it as part of the Wellcome Foundation's mega exploration of the concept of beauty. They pitched to us to ask if our film would be part of their project. Couldn't make that up. I'm so proud of this film. Now that it's in a, you know, semi-permanent residence in central London, of course, lots of friends are asking me to take them to see it with them. And I keep seeing new versions of it, because as you sit with somebody that you care about, you're looking at it through their fresh eyes. And my very eclectic social circle means that my imagination has been stretched in all kinds of directions as I think about what they're experiencing and the wonderful conversations we're having after we've watched the film together. And it's basically our take on beauty from a very specific, highly creative, deeply researched perspective that is, despite all of those specializations, turning out to be very accessible and relevant to all sorts of people, many of whom are not Black or queer or fashion-y or any of the things that would make you think you needed to be in those gangs to get the film. It has a universal message. And at this end, this part of my career, because I, you know, I'm getting to the end of things, I'm just so thrilled that there's been this explosion of an opportunity to do something that has landed so well.
About time. Just saying. About time. When we move to your artists, which are, again, a quite an eclectic collection of artists. But I'll let you speak to your artists, because...
Well, the first artist has to be Rotimi Fanekeyere, not because he's the first artist that I was really aware of, but because meeting him changed my life. When I met Rotimi Fanekeyere in early 1987, I think it was, I was just a keen hobbyist photographer. I was working in publishing, to and fro into Nigeria, doing my very kind of straight, vanilla, mainstream, but quite fascinating thing. And I was at a Black gay social group, and somebody who knew of Rotimi Fanekeyere whispered in my ear, "You know who's in the room, don't you?" kind of thing. And I said, "Who?" looking around, room full of Black queer men. And he pointed me out to Rotimi and then sort of manhandled me across the room and introduced me. And I quickly realized, just from this man's presence, that I needed to be paying attention. My way of getting into this was to rather grandly commission Rotimi to take my picture so that I could get a sense of what all the fuss was about. So I booked a session with him, and yeah, the pictures are nice enough, but what really grabbed me was going into the studio of a true artist and observing the way he worked, the way he handled the camera, the way he worked with me, and the seriousness with which he took what he was doing. And it suddenly occurred to me, oh my God, this is an art form. It's not just a way of making nice pictures. And at a quite a deeply instinctive level, I knew it was time for a big change. And although I had a very nice life as it was, at that session, it became clear to me that this was the direction I was going in. And within, in very short order, I changed my life around, left publishing and dived in to photography. And Rotimi had a big hand in the early stages. He was a very brilliant informal mentor. We never used the M word, but he was so generous in the way he encouraged me, supported my efforts, and allowed me to photograph him as much as he photographed me. And he was making waves. He was, you know, having big exhibitions and getting a lot of plaudits in some serious spaces. And let's be frank about it. In those days, there weren't that many opportunities around funding and exhibition and publicity for anything black and queer. So it wasn't an instinctive thing for him to be being so generous to somebody who, I'm not claiming I was any competition, but in terms of the white gatekeepers, you know, I was crowding the space, but that wasn't the issue with him. Anyway, long story short, we had a great time together, having a lot of fun photographing each other, and he was very generous in what he taught me. And I got my first opportunity to have an exhibition in a serious space in America. Now, the images that I'd created and the negatives were high quality enough, but I hadn't yet mastered the craft of exhibition printmaking. And he very kindly sacrificed a lot of his own time one weekend to help me make the prints, get them ready, and get them shipped over to the States in time for the exhibition. And about 2 or 3 days after we'd done all that, I had a phone call from his partner, the writer Alex Hurst, telling me that Rotimi had been taken ill. So my first instinct was to dive in and say, well, when can I go and visit him in hospital? And Alex said to me, well, give it a week or so because it's infectious and they won't be letting any visitors in. But I'll call you in about a week's time and I'm sure you can go and visit him. Alex called me about a week later to tell me that Rotimi had died suddenly from a massive heart attack, complications with the condition that he had. Well, it was shocking and very hard to process because this man had just laid out for me a whole new way of seeing the world, had literally changed my life. And I was looking forward to enjoying what was, I thought, us at the threshold of a great long connection, learning from each other, having fun together. And suddenly he was gone. 21st of December, 1989, Rotimi Fanny Coyote, dead at 34. It sent ripples throughout the queer and not just queer art world. And I remember thinking one of his biggest splashes was a half-page illustrated obituary in a broadsheet newspaper. It was just so weird and ironic that, you know, that biggest splash at that time was the thing. He's gone on to have an amazing 30-odd year posthumous career, all kinds of books written about him, exhibitions. And I've been a little kind of micro industry myself, giving lots of talks about him, being invited on radio and all kinds of things to talk about him. And as recently as this year at Queer Britain, which is the relatively new queer history museum, I was asked to make and lead a Black History Month event, which I made all about Rotimi, but from a very personal point of view, which is a very moving and rewarding experience, taking that opportunity to make sure that 30 odd years after he died, people will not forget his name because he really matters. He still really matters. My next artist is Francis Bacon, the painter who we've already talked about. In a very different way, because it wasn't that I identified with Francis Bacon, but I was excited by the outrageousness of his life and the bold, dark power of his work. I just, for anybody who doesn't know his work, you know, buckle up and dive in. There's an awful lot to see. A very brave and dynamic artist who, for me, more than delivers on the hype, which isn't always the case with some of the great names. And finally, we come to the contemporary. Zanelli Moholy, the stunningly talented, charismatic, Black, queer, I say woman, though I know that now there's reference to being non-binary, but when I met them, they were a fierce lesbian photographer. And here's the funny thing. I'll tell a short story about Zanelli. Back in 2015, before they were really a big name on the scene, Autograph, the Association of Black Photographers, had given Zanelli my contact details because Zanelli wanted to come to my little studio in London to interview me and photograph me and do a little film clip about me as one of a series of paying respect to Black queer elders. Well, when I got over the shock and stopped looking over my shoulder to think, who are they talking about? Oh, me. You know, I welcomed Zanelli and their assistant into my flat. And it was really funny they were so sweet and so kind and so generous. And I eventually just found some grace and decided to let it happen. And we had a lovely time together. But just now, as it happened, they were having trouble with one of their tripods. And I, by accident, bought two tripods that were very similar, and I really didn't need one. And in a moment, I was a bit flush at the time, and in a moment of just madness, maybe, I just said to Zanelli, well, look, why don't, there's one here. Why don't you use it? And why don't you keep it? Because I have no use for it. It's too similar to the one I have. And we carried on with the shoot, and it was done, and off they went. A few years passed, and suddenly Zanelli's name is popping up in major international spaces, winning awards, getting major retrospective shows all over the place. And then I was commissioned by an Oxford art project to curate an exhibition of leading women photographers. And I was given access to a massive database of about 200 people I could choose from, international, you know, high profile photographers. And there were lots of people I wanted to work with. And then I thought, if I could get Zanelli. But of course, by this stage, Zanelli was walking on water and floating in the heavens. And the organization had tried to reach Zanelli and not getting anywhere. And I thought, how low can I go? I got Zanelli's email address and wrote a really smarmy email. First of all, starting with a congratulatory message about the huge success since we'd met in my humble little studio, and hoping that the tripod was still working. Oh, and by the way, I'm curating an exhibition. Would you consider honoring us with access to, say, a dozen of your images? It would make the world of difference to the credibility of our project. Held my breath, pressed send, and to my delighted amazement, Zanelli came straight back to me and was just so generous in making images available. And the organizers of the art festival in Oxford thought I was somebody if I could get Zanelli. And there's a lovely little postscript to this tale after that very happy outcome. Earlier this year, I was in Paris on holiday. Now, we have to remember, Zanelli lives in South Africa near Johannesburg. I'm walking down a street in Paris, and who is walking up the street but Zanelli? If you think of the likelihood that you're going to be bumping into this international star on the afternoon, in the hour, in the minute when you're turning a corner to walk down whatever it was, avenue, and there is Zanelli walking in the other direction. We just shrieked, grabbed each other, and I don't know what people around us thought was going on, but it was such an exciting moment and such a wild coincidence. It was just a magical moment. I should say, I've said all this about the person. What I haven't said is enough about Zanelli's work. The work that I'm most familiar with, although Zanelli celebrates all kinds of aspects of the Black queer experience and beyond, I was particularly interested in Zanelli's self-portraits, a kind of self-portrait where basically exploring all kinds of archetypal and not so archetypal queer identities, but with brilliant, brilliant art direction and use of various kinds of props and unusual textures and items and atmospheres to generate this endless set of possibilities of identity. I just love the work. And I was so proud last year to go to Tate Britain and walk around a major international gallery and see the walls packed with this artist's work. It just made me so pleased and so proud.
What memories or flashbacks do this selection bring back for you? Is there sort of like other memories that are related to these collections?
Of course. Well, as I said at the top of the program, I chose these because they're about things that have a contemporary resonance, even if some of them reach back a long way. If I tried to do my life story, we'd need hours and it would probably be quite tedious. But going back to the songs, when I choose one song, right at the beginning of my discovering Stevie Wonder, before he became mega, 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 what is always going to be there for me is There Would Never Be Enough Time to cover all the things I appreciate about Stevie Wonder's music and his life. And it was interesting, during the lockdown, my partner and I had a lot more time to be on our own, relaxing. And we decided informally that we would just dive into the CV, my collection of Stevie CDs from the early days right through to the latest that I own. And what was so rewarding and rich was just hearing them again, reappreciating the writing, the singing, the production values. So there was always this thing with Stevie Wonder, the music press were quite side-eye about the time it took for him to turn out his albums and the delays in actually getting the things out. But when you heard those albums, you understood why. This is, again, excellence. And the impact that that man has had on the music scene throughout all kinds of genres and different kinds of characters. He's a colossus. And he's the backdrop to all of my formative years. And when I think about Chaka Khan, it's not just that she can sing so well and she can make it so witty and carnal and fun, but that she's so smart. What I've always enjoyed about her, yeah, she can wail, but you know there's an intelligence in there. She knows what she's doing. It's the control. Fantastic. And I probably said enough about David McAlmont and the joy of working with him and his inestimable talent, but it's one of the thrills of my life to have worked closely with a friend and feel closer to that friend afterwards, because they always say don't work with animals and children and whatever else, but also that there's a one in brackets, don't work with your friends if you want to keep them. Well, we got away with it. We had a good time. As to the books, with any good book, there are things that I usually want to return to, because I'll keep finding new things in them, either because I missed them the first or third or second or third time, or because I've changed and my perspective brings a different way of cultivating what's there. The films, I've probably said enough about the films, though it's weird to be still discovering so much about a film that I was part of the production of. that is quite funny. And Zanelli, well, still young enough to have a massive career ahead of them. And I hope I can get to South Africa, as I've been invited. They've invited me very generously. It's a question of getting things sorted out to get out there and maybe make it some kind of contribution. We'll see.
How important do you think these conversations are, and collecting or archiving some of our voices in our own words?
I think what you're doing with this lovely project is absolutely, absolutely rich and powerful and positive in what it makes possible. I've listened to some of the other contributors, and apart from leaving me slightly intimidated, like, oh, so what have I got to say? But it's just lovely to hear living histories. I will, if you'll forgive me, mention a little bit more about Queer Britain, which is a charity that was the seed of an idea back in 2017-18, and it's already in its first building and doing a lot of work with not just exhibitions of things about famous people, but one of the core aspects of the mission of Queer Britain is to democratize and enrich our idea of what history is. And it's about the first person testimonies of people who were there, not just on screens or in famous books or in fabulous galleries, but living complicated and fascinating lives. And when you ask people questions and people answer them, you know, there's so much to learn and so much to appreciate. So you're doing in this project an aspect of what we're trying to do at Queer Britain. So I'm there for it. I'm a fan.
Thank you. You kind of answered the next question, which is hopes and dreams. Hopes and dreams.
Well, hopes and dreams, I suppose, coming back to the very personal, and I've not really said this in public before, at 65, I'm realizing the energies that I have for certain things are more refined now. I don't need to show up and be there and be seen. It's much more about the quality of the experience and why I would be using my time doing one thing rather than another. And so I think my relationship with photography is evolving. I still love it, but I think I want to evolve in a circular way back to the place where when I pick up a camera, it's for pure pleasure. It's not running after the money, or it's not running after trying to be famous or have somebody see it. It's because the person or the subject or the situation or the possibilities for collaboration really pull me. That's why I'd be there. And I've noticed, particularly in the last 4 or 5 years, I am just getting more and more caught up with not only buying lots of jewelry, but making jewelry, being more adventurous in what I wear and getting into, I've even taken a basic garment construction course at Morley College just before the lockdown. And I'm enjoying just getting involved in other kinds of creativity. And also, I guess my social network is changing. I'm just finding myself drawn to places that are not the usual for me. So I'm just hoping I'm granted enough sanity and energy to, you know, have a few years exploring these new terrains. But the camera will always be there. It'll just be a different relationship to it.
This has been magnificent. And with the magnificent Robert Taylor, need I say, that was our cue list. I suggest everybody follow the links and find out as much as you can about Robert Taylor.
That was amazing. Thank you for taking the time to have this conversation and talking to us about your cue list. Thank you for listening to The Cue List. Can be found on www.samesamebutblack.co.nz, IG, Facebook, and all other social media platforms.